that's a great musical twofer, two for the price of one, the Duke Ellington and Count Basie Orchestras with Battle Royal. That was recorded in 1961. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, December the 19th. And Representative Charles Rangel, a Democrat who has represented New York's Harlem, which is now technically the Upper West Side, since very little of Harlem remains, for more than four decades, since 1971, announced today that he will seek a 23rd term in Congress. He is 83 years old. Two issues are going to be tackled today, and actually they're added on from our discussion that we had yesterday. I'll be talking a bit more about the supermole, Edward Snowden, and the mysteries that surround him. That's the second half of the program. But first, why Obamacare should be the death knell for the two-party system. You know, the announcement by Rangel today that he's going to go a 23rd term, and he cites as his reason, and I'm quoting here, that he is going to put his experience, knowledge of Washington, his seniority, his passion for serving the people of his district to help the president achieve his agenda over the next 2 years. And that, in a way, introduces the issue. Obamacare is perhaps the best and most visible piece of evidence of what is wrong, not just with the Democratic Party or with the president himself, but with the entire system. This notion that people can have infinite choices in just about everything except politics. And politics, of course, you know, controls our daily lives. Every indication so far has been given that there is something fundamentally wrong, illegal, unsustainable about the Affordable Care Act. And let's take a little view from the side, okay? There's the act itself. Look how much money, at a time that the nation supposedly is financially strapped and the people are watching their pennies. They're not watching pennies in Washington. If you were to total up the billions of dollars spent so far in just defending Obamacare, just defending it, putting it together, and then defending it, you would see how ridiculous this is, this business about, quote, democracy. This is how it works? Is this how it's supposed to work? There's no money to subsidize people's health and make it a single-payer system. But you have billions of dollars to spend on a site that isn't working, to spend on lawyers to construct the hundreds of thousands of pages of regulations and fine print and all this stuff associated with the Affordable Care Act, and the money that's going now into lawsuit after lawsuit that is, I mean, these lawsuits are legitimate. They are basically contesting how the very nature of this bill. This bill, as we've discussed here many times, this bill literally is illegal. But, and we hear the refrain all the time, it is the law. And as horrible as this bill began, as horribly as this bill began, and as illegally as this bill began, because this bill never came out, as I've said time and again, it never came out of a committee process. It was not part of open discussion and debate. This was rammed through Congress. The President, Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, they rammed this thing through. No Republican got to vote on this. And in the people who did vote on it had no clue what it is. In fact, it was Nancy Pelosi. You heard me say this here on this program. And I even played the tape for you. And this bill is so important that you must first vote for it before I tell you what's in it. That's what she said. And she said this to elected officials. So this bill was born in the crucible of an undemocratic process by scheming people. The president just put so much elastic into his power as an executive, and this is the genesis of a whole lot of the lawsuits that are coming down the pike. There's one very significant one coming down the pike from Oklahoma, which, again, challenges the power of this chief executive or the nation's leader as to how he could basically decide that he is the law, can make the law. He could decide that every person needs to have this or else, you know, pay a penalty. And then he got the Supreme Court, none other than the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, to physically rewrite this piece of legislation so that the IRS is the ultimate authority. The IRS can now criminalize a person's decision to not go along with this program. In other words, this is a program in which nobody has a choice. Either way, you have to pay. They're going to get you. And this is the president, the man who is supposed to be the great constitutional whiz, the guy who loves Abraham Lincoln and the Constitution and talks all the time about the forefathers and whatever else he wants to throw in there, wraps himself in the American flag and talks emotionally about the need for everybody to have a good access to health care, as if that was ever a point of debate. It was never debated. But this is gangster politics. This is bottom line Chicago gangster politics. And I could do whatever it is I want to do. And this is the basis of the lawsuit that's coming up soon from Oklahoma. 34 states are saying they don't want to be bothered with this because it's just so wrong. And the federal government is now intruding on states' rights. It is not the president who makes these decisions. It's Congress who makes these decisions. But the president said, hey, I am the law. I'm it. Not one single Democrat, Charlie Rangel included, has had the moral fiber, the courage, or the guts to step forward and say, hey, wait a minute, folks. I don't agree with this. You see the evidence laid out before you. I talked about it just yesterday. 5 million people, and I said this was coming down the pike, 5 million people that, according to the reports, are overwhelmingly, disproportionately was the word, disproportionately African American and Latino, will have absolutely no access. They're not even talking about them. So the Democratic Party, as a party, you have to write it off. There is nobody in the Democratic Party really speaking from a position of not just conscience, but of what's right. It is not right. I don't care what people say about it. It is not right. And the money that is being spent to basically entrench a putrid piece of legislation, simply to say, well, it's Obama's legislation, and what? He's entitled, therefore, because he chose to do this the wrong way and chose at every turn to break the law and to get complicity in breaking the law, only to get his way, and this is my thing. This is the one thing that is going to stand for my legacy. This is not, you know, an ego trip here. You're dealing with people's lives. And you will note that there is no section of the Democratic Party, not the progressives, as they call themselves, not the liberals. Nobody in the Democratic Party has voiced a basic difference of opinion about Obamacare. They all fell in line. Why? Because, you know, this is Chicago politics. If you don't fall in line, the party makes it difficult for you to win. And Congress is about winning every 2 years, or every 4 years, or every 6 years, if you want to climb the ladder. And you have to look to the treasure chest to help you through with your campaigns. Money, money, money corrupts. This president, I don't care what anybody says. I understand it's a good thing to have health care. It's always been said this is not a new concept. But they don't have the courage to make it what it ought to be, which is a single-payer system. Instead, they're feeding. All of these Democrats have agreed to feed the least able to defend themselves against this kind of tyranny. Feed them into the grinding machine. We just want numbers. Because it's part of the plan. We are going to satisfy the pay-to-play corporate healthcare people. It's our gift to them. And they all agree. Not one person of conscience. So that the Democrats are right off. And then you look on the other side. And your choice is this: the lesser of the two evils, or the evil of the two lessers. Take your pick. Republicans are locked into, oh, we got to fight them because, well, hey, we just got to fight. They're not offering anything that is sensible or credible alternative, something that suggests that other than the vitriol and the knee-jerk reaction and the soundbite and the pandering to what they call conservatives — you could call them conservatives if you want, I call them racists — to the racist element out there that says, hey, you know what? If there's going to be money spent on health care, the last people it ought to be spent on are these poor people. They're sucking up too many of our resources, and we should be here subsidizing them anyway. That's as far as they get. That is as far as their intellectual argument goes. So on the one hand, you have the Democrats who've lost their mind, and the chief executive who believes that it is an absolute monarchy, and he is the monarch. You have that, and you have a mishmash of a Republican organization that still doesn't know where it is, on the political lines that you should be able to draw by now. Which is why, if there is mercy in this world, there would be a bunch of political parties in formation as I speak to save this country from what it already is on, which is a very slippery slope. This bill should represent to everybody This, I keep calling it a bill. It's the law I forgot. This law is so wrong on so many levels. But if it is standing as it is, if we have people like Rangel at 83 saying, oh, let me at him again for another 2 years, and, you know, you say, well, why shouldn't we let you at it for another 2 years? Look at Harlem. Look at Harlem. Harlem used to be the black political capital of the world. It has produced all this political power. It produced a governor, the first borough president of Manhattan, the first African-American mayor, lieutenant governor. It produced Rangel, at one point, the fourth most powerful member of Congress. And look at Harlem. All this political power does not translate to benefits for the people. Harlem has been systematically disemboweled, eviscerated, with all this political power coming out of it. So we don't need it. It's proof that whatever produced that is not something that anybody should desire. Move on to something different. Create something new. So Obamacare has proven that the Democratic Party has lost its moral compass. I mean, almost completely lost it. I mean, keep looking. Who is going to stand up and say, nope, I oppose this. This is wrong. This is not going to be beneficial to my community. And we need to fix this. Or fight like hell before it became law. Instead, there were party to it. And they were like lemmings. Imagine a Nancy Pelosi telling people, vote for it before we tell you what's in it. And you are representing distressed communities where the health disparity is almost at a historic level. People poor, even the president talked about the inequality being the issue of our time. Whoa, I'm glad he woke up to that one. So the Democratic Party has lost its soul. It doesn't have it anymore. The Republicans, they can't figure out what to do. And this has been going on for years. So it's a time to start the process of constructing something different. The people deserve a wider choice. They deserve to hear new ideas. They deserve to be open to other political thinking and ways of doing things. And it should be a case where people should have the confidence that, in fact, the democratic system is one that encourages this, not retards it, but encourages it. The question is, who has the guts to step forward? I'm looking at the third parties and they all scampered to the hills. This should be their finest hour. They should be fighting tooth and nail. They should be very visible on this issue. They should be the alternatives that people are looking for and wanting to hear from. But there's silence. So maybe they too have made themselves irrelevant. But in any event, this Obamacare is the reason that we ought to see an end, the death of the two-party system. It doesn't work. It's not intended to work. It will not work. And there's no reason to keep feeding it, feeding this process with your votes. There's no reason to reward this non-working process with your votes. So pretty soon we have to come to a decision, and of course there's an election around the corner. Can we misbehave enough to send the message that this is just way beneath our standard, this whole process? Obamacare is an abomination. And particularly so because it punishes more ruthlessly than any other community the very constituencies that brought this administration into power. It ought to exact a price for being so disgraced and let down and betrayed. So I hope third parties are listening out there, that they ought to be, if they are in fact third parties, get into the communities, get into the fray, get into the gap, and let's hear what your ideas are. There's no reason for you to hide and you know, create a bunker mentality and just disappear. This is where you ought to be. You ought to be in the fight. You ought to be heard. You ought to be very, very visible. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say about Obamacare today. I think there's much more coming, but it is important to say that, you know, I am offended. I am offended by this bill. I'm offended by this law, whatever the heck it is, the law. I'm offended by it. I am very much offended by it. And so I made up my decision a long time ago. The Democratic Party will not get my vote ever again until it changes. And it recognizes that this is not a game where the winners get to have their hands in the till. And it's not about a president having power because, oh, he's the first black guy to have this power. No. This is about whether you have the capacity to lead and not. You know, people talk about what the previous administrations have done. This particular president has, I mean, turn that stuff up exponentially. So let's see if we could encourage third parties out there with your calls to them and call them out. What are they hiding for? Why are they not visible? Why aren't they talking about this and presenting a workable alternative? I'll come back right after this short musical break, and we'll talk about the super mole, Mr. Snowden, and his curious friends. You're listening to PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. The program is Lead Stories. And adding on to what we've been talking about Ed Snowden et al. So far, we've talked about some very interesting questions raised, and I haven't heard these issues raised before in the media. I still haven't seen any discussion on these lines. Sybil Denise Edmonds is a former Federal Bureau of Investigation translator. She is the founder of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and she has been writing on her page, boilingfrogs.com, about major questions that she has about Ed Snowden. And yesterday we dealt with 8 questions, she says, that Snowden needs to answer now because his credibility rests on it. Essentially, what has been reported is that Ed Snowden, who had given, or he says he had given, all of the files that he stole from the NSA to 2 reporters, Glenn Greenwald, who writes for The Guardian and was in fact the first person to leak out one of the major issues about privacy rights and so forth of what the government is doing, and Laura Poitras, who is a documentarian. And we've learned so far that apparently there is a $250 million deal that has been cut by Mr. Greenwald and Ms. Poitras, and the owner of PayPal, who also owns eBay. And that these questions are beginning to make this issue not so much about one person claiming, oh, I can't allow the government to invade the privacy rights of individuals, and as an American, I must speak up. I said early on in this game, very early on, don't trust it. You don't know who these people are or what it is they're doing. I found an interesting article written by Michael Kelly, who writes for the Business Insider, and he writes specifically about military and defense. I want to read you what he filed on September the 3rd of this year. The title of the piece is, Did WikiLeaks Sell Out Snowden to the Russians? I will read you the article. Is it just a coincidence that former NSA analyst Edward Snowden, a valuable intelligence asset, ended up in the hands of Russia's security services? Or did WikiLeaks, the anti-secrecy organization that has taken responsibility for Snowden, send him there in collaboration with the Russians? Former U.S. intelligence analyst Joshua Faust makes a compelling argument that WikiLeaks may have been infiltrated by Russia's Federal Security Bureau, the post-Soviet successor to the KGB. His argument is based on the shared history between WikiLeaks and Russia, how Snowden ended up in Russia, and what happened to Snowden once he landed in Moscow. Looking at the same evidence, we think this is certainly a possibility. Faust points out that in October 2010, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said, quote, we have compromising materials about Russia, about your government and businessmen. We will publish these materials soon, unquote. Subsequently, an FSB, that's again the successor of the KGB, an FSB official issued a threat via independent Russian news website Life News. Quote, it's essential to remember that given the will and the relevant orders, WikiLeaks can be made inaccessible forever, unquote. Those files were never published. In December 2010, Israel Shamir, a friend of Assange, provided Russian ally Belarus with a cache of WikiLeaks files about opposition members in the country. In 2012, the government-funded Russian TV station RT gave Assange his own talk show. Faust states that, quote, the chain of events leading up to Snowden's flight and his decision in Hong Kong to flee to Russia, of all places, strongly suggest that Russian intel has co-opted him to a remarkable degree, unquote. Peter Maas of the New York Times reported that Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, the two primary journalists Snowden has been working with, didn't speak with Snowden between June 9th in Hong Kong and early July. On June 19th, Assange said WikiLeaks was providing legal counsel to Snowden, helping him get asylum in Iceland. Around that time, Assange's closest advisor, Sarah Harrison, met Snowden in Hong Kong. The organization also paid for Snowden's lodgings in Hong Kong. Kommersant, a daily business paper in Russia, reported that Snowden spent several days in the Russian consulate in Hong Kong, starting either June the 20th or 21st, after meeting Harrison. Will Englund of the Washington Post noted that the Kommersant article, quote, implies that Snowden's decision to seek Russian help came after he was joined in Hong Kong by Sarah Harrison, unquote. The U.S. requested that Hong Kong extradite Snowden on June the 20th. On June the 21st, according to Kommersant, the U.S. voided the 30-year-old's passport, and he bought a ticket to Cuba via Russia. Also on June the 21st, Reuters quoted Olafur Vigdir Sigurvinsson, that's as best as I could pronounce it, an Icelandic businessman linked to WikiLeaks, as saying he had readied a private plane to take Snowden to Iceland if the government granted him asylum. Nevertheless, on June the 23rd, Snowden flew to Moscow, and the decision, quote, was made in consultation with WikiLeaks, unquote, the Wall Street Journal reported. Harrison, that is WikiLeaks CEO Assange's assistant, a British citizen who reportedly has a Russian visa, accompanied him. Snowden was able to travel because Assange had convinced Ecuador's consul in London to provide a document requesting that authorities allow Snowden to travel to Ecuador via Russia, quote, for the purpose of political asylum, unquote. The country's president subsequently said the document was, quote, completely invalid, unquote. Once Snowden arrived in Moscow the next day with useless travel papers, all signs suggest that Russia's domestic intelligence service, that is the FSB, took control of him. That day, a radio host in Moscow, quote, saw about 20 Russian officials, supposedly FSB agents, in suits, crowding around somebody in a restricted area of the airport, unquote, according to Anna Nemstova of Foreign Policy. On July the 12th, the day Snowden appeared with the FSB's public relations officer and accepted all offers of asylum, Faust wrote that the, quote, involvement of known FSB operatives at his asylum acceptance suggests this was a textbook intelligence operation and not a brave plea for asylum, unquote. Snowden subsequently hired Anatoly Kucherena, a Moscow lawyer who is linked to the FSB, to advise him. Kucherena has publicly spoken for Snowden since then. And on August the 1st, he said Snowden was taken to, quote, a secure location, unquote, after receiving asylum in Russia. Kucherena set up Snowden's new life in Russia. Evidence showing the FSB's close supervision of Snowden appears to contradict claims from WikiLeaks that it has maintained control of the whistleblower. WikiLeaks announced on August the 1st that Harrison, quote, has remained with Mr. Snowden at all times to protect his safety and security, unquote. But Kucherena subsequently told BuzzFeed that he, quote, only saw her at his first and last meetings with Snowden at Sheremetyevo Airport, unquote. And Assange claimed that Snowden has not even been interviewed by the FSB or any other Russian intelligence agency during his stay in Russia. But the presence of the FSB's PR officer and a lawyer who sits on the FSB's public counsel are among the several reasons to doubt this notion. Quote, without a doubt, a person with inside knowledge like that, live and in the flesh, would be a very useful catch, unquote, Mikhail Lyubinov, a 20-year-old veteran of the KGB spying told Time, quote, he is carrying information of great importance, unquote. WikiLeaks advised Snowden in Hong Kong, reportedly before he chose to stay at the Russian consulate, and secured his flight to Moscow, where he was promptly stranded. Ever since, Snowden's affairs have been handled by his Moscow lawyer, who is connected to Russian intelligence. Those circumstances led Faust to conclude, quote, pretending WikiLeaks did not deliver Snowden to the FSB requires ignoring a preponderance of evidence to the contrary, unquote. He added that, quote, maybe working so closely with Russia wasn't such a bad idea after all. WikiLeaks has lived to fight another day, unquote. Interesting. The article says, did, in fact, Ed Snowden, did he get played by WikiLeaks Julian Assange? I encourage you to go to businessinsider.com and read for yourself the article I just read to you verbatim, September the 3rd, 2013, by Michael Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, who writes on military and defense matters. And there's a corresponding update that he filed on December the 16th, in which he talks about the value of Snowden because he has 31,000 critical documents and of intense interest to the intelligence community, not just the U.S. intelligence community, but the worldwide intelligence community. So this brings us back to the question that Sybil Edmonds had raised. Did Ed Snowden just have this revelation once he was in the CIA and the NSA, and he decided that he would download these files? But he has said the files are in perfect order, they're all assembled and so forth, so somebody must have advised him as to what to look for. In other words, and he did say, he went there purposely to do this. Now, they're standing publicly with this, they're selling the world this notion, especially the United States, but the whole world, that they're standing up for freedom and democracy and the rights of individuals not to have their privacy invaded. But I caution you, that is possibly, very possibly, a ruse to get world sympathy for what really is a high-stakes game played by these individuals. And Snowden probably didn't even calculate the enormity of what it is he was doing. It suggests to me that Snowden was, at some point, a willing actor in this game. And I did say from the very beginning that the reason we know his identity is that he was clear that they were closing in on him, and he made it public so as to protect himself, his life, if you will. We learn now that there's this multi-million dollar business deal by people who say they're journalists. When did Glenn Greenwald become a journalist? No, he is in possession of stolen material. We don't know anything about this. And nobody's asking anybody to explain themselves. Nobody's asking Snowden. People have been on the bandwagon. Ed Snowden is a hero. You don't even know what he is. But I did tell you from the beginning, this thing ain't smelling right. And my questions are, who is this guy? Who are you? Who are you working for? I asked those specific questions. Who are you working for? And then he arrives at this point, as I talked about yesterday, because, you know, we've gone through three waves of civilization, the agrarian wave, and then we went to the industrial era, and then we went to the information era, and we're now in the virtual era. And people like Julian Assange and Ed Snowden see themselves literally as presidents of a virtual country. Isn't it curious? Isn't it curious that all of this stuff is going on and nobody's putting the dots together and saying, well, wait a minute, there's way too much here to ignore. How did you end up with the CIA traveling all over the place? These folks, as I did theorize very early in the game, I would not be surprised if under the guidance of, say, a Julian Assange or a Julian Assange type, there are people being groomed, people with very good skills, being groomed to do this kind of thing, which they use to great financial advantage. Because in possession of very, very sensitive information, despite the fact of what the United States is saying, or what Russia is saying, or China, or whoever it might be, for expediency's sake and to protect the innards of their intelligence gathering capabilities, they could be encouraged to break a deal with somebody. It's always about money. I haven't seen any reporting in the major media yet questioning this Glenn Greenwald. How did he get to arrange this deal of $250 million predicated on these files, these sensitive files? And by the way, again, the announcement was made by Snowden himself that he has handed over these files and they will be disseminated. Things would be revealed all over the place. We learned so far from Sybil Edmonds and others that they have disseminated 1%, and somebody's holding on to 99%, and it's the 99% they're using as the bait, as the incentive to cut this multi-million dollar deal. These are vile, vile creatures. So before anybody goes, you know, overboard in supporting something they don't know about, I agree. Mr. Snowden needs to answer some questions. And the gall that he had in supposedly addressing the Brazilian people, who are you? Who are you? You know nothing, wherever it is. You happen to know a couple of things. You're good at computers, great for you. You're going to address the Brazilian people like you have some kind of currency as head of state of some country, you know. And by doing so, as I said yesterday, he did something so offensive on so many levels. He wouldn't dare do that in Russia because he can't move. He can't move from Russia. Not for a while, because he has to stay there a year. That's the deal they cut. He can't move. But what he will do, as he did with this publication of his letter to the Brazilian people, is create havoc. He is creating havoc in Brazil. And here is a head of state just trying to get her country together. And as I said yesterday again, the intention, and she has made this clear, with the revelation about how the United States is capturing information from other countries and heads of state of other countries, she's taking the whole servers, all of the servers out of the U.S. And that's going to be a huge loss of business to the tech community. Now, the tech community itself, I had a guest here, Kotkin, who had talked about the rise of the new oligarchs. These are people like Assange, and you know, they are excellent at what they do. But there are no checks and balances where they're concerned. Nobody's asking them what they did or might be still doing, prying into people's private lives. So people were very quick to embrace Mr. Snowden, as they did with Mr. Assange, because, hey, they're the underdogs, and they're going up against the mighty. But are they actually going up against the mighty in order to get the almighty dollar? Are they really true and true? Are they the real thing, the real McCoy? Or are they just a bunch of really very dangerous people who have created a world in which they loom very large, or at least they think they do? But Mr. Snowden has already realized that whatever he thought the game was going to be, it way outweighs his capacity to control it. It's a very dangerous game. And we ought to be very, very careful about these kinds of things. I encourage you again to read this. There are two articles. One filed on September the 3rd, 2013, by Michael Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y. He writes on military and defense for the Business Insider. And his most recent article on December the 16th, talking about whether the idea of amnesty revolves around 31,000 critical documents that he allegedly still has in his possession. We don't know. But we know enough to be troubled by the cast of characters and what seems to have gone on. But, you know, there's a lot of this going on in the world of, quote, journalism, unquote. Checkbook journalism has always been the bane of our existence, so you never know. All right. I also urge you to go to boilingfrogs.com, boilingfrogs.com. That's Sybil Edmonds' website. And it's from there yesterday that I got, because she says she's not talking to the media until she feels comfortable that there are answers to some of these questions. But she has nonetheless written some very strong pieces that raise these questions. And read the questions for yourself. Or you can certainly go to the archive. I read the questions yesterday. Check out the archive and see where it takes you. Go to Lead Stories. Check for yesterday's program on Wednesday the 18th. You certainly can download it. And you can hear why this is an issue. And I want to see which paper or which medium is going to really grab it and expose it for what it is. I want to thank you for joining me today. We've come to the end of our program. Tomorrow, of course, is yet another day. You can always reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com, or on Facebook at Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. And it's a pleasure always to hear from you. And I'd like to know what you're thinking or how these programs are resonating with you, if they are, in fact, resonating with you. So thank you so much for your company today. You want to stay tuned. Coming up next is Occupied Territory, America with Mike Fader. And we are out of here. See you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Pass the word. Let other people know. PRN is your favorite station. And, of course, you have a special warm spot in your heart for this particular program. Bye-bye.